Channel 2 over. Channel 2 over. Saturday morning, the 6th of December, 6 to 9. Channel 2 over. Channel 2 over. Channel 2 over. The continuation after breakfast on Saturday, the 6th of December, 6 to 9. Channel 2 over. And a continuation of the talk after breakfast on 6th of December, 6 to 9. Channel 2 over. Channel 2 over. Continuation of the talk after breakfast, Saturday, the 6th of December, 6 to 9.
You can get off and leave. And I meant it.
She wasn't used to that.
She wasn't used to it that strongly, I'm sure, because it was the very first day and she'd hardly done anything yet. But she wasn't paying attention to what I was saying, and I told her she could get off and go home, as far as I was concerned.
Now, that's what Celia did occasionally.
Occasionally. If somebody was not paying attention and just refusing to pay attention, she'd simply say, I won't teach you. You can get off. Take your horse out and cool him out and put him up. Make sure it's done right.
Now, Barbara Helen
had stopped practicing. And she said she'd never met, she told the student that she never met anybody so vain to think that they could play the world's masterpieces without practicing. And that if she had two choices, she could either practice or she could go take lessons under someone else.
Well, now, that's the sort of Celia, I don't associate that with the roughhouse, Barbara.
Well, Celia was always, or not always, usually, for one thing, with any of these people, their manner in a lesson, and it's true with me too, my manner in a lesson is not the same as when the lesson's over. And that you can draw a line the minute my lesson starts and the minute it ends by the way I talk to my students. And this is the thing that makes it possible to teach people that you're around 24 hours a day. You can't keep the same attitude in a lesson. You just can't, or you don't have any respect. Now, the minute she started a lesson, there was no joking around, especially at first. Now, later on, we'd have lessons occasionally when we'd cut up like mad. But at first, there was nothing like that. Lessons were strict. They were, her manner was professional. And we didn't cut out. We either did what we were told or we did nothing. I mean, you know, just sat there. Now later on, especially towards the end of the year, we had some really wild lessons when we would just all be in a good mood and play around. Especially the teaching lessons tended to be like that, when one of us would have to teach the others. And the others would all cut up and give funny names and do exactly everything wrong and ride as poorly as they could. And all those lessons could get really funny. And we'd do it even if, now some scenes, Anne, for instance, or some of the girls were so serious about trying to teach and would just get, now if you're too serious about it, you can't get into discipline. And some of these girls would come in there and be terribly, terribly serious about it, and we would cut up and do everything wrong, and they'd practically be in tears and so angry. And a few lessons like that was good for them. Because you can't teach children and get angry and upset if they don't do what you tell them to, or even if they do the opposite of what you tell them to. You can be firm, but you can't be upset, or they'll just laugh at you. I've had it happen myself, so I know. And So we would give them a rough time, and Celia would just sit up there and laugh herself sick. I mean, she'd enjoy it. It was a good show. But unless we got too hard, too rough, or too would really stop playing, you know, the lesson and make it impossible for the person to teach. You could make it impossible for the best instructors in the world to teach if we tried hard enough. But and then she would, you know, she'd say something. But most of the time, and if she wanted us to be serious, she'd start the lesson off, and now we're going to have teaching instruction, and be serious, please. And we would be. I mean, you know. But it was possible to have a really just a lesson that was nothing but a good time, occasionally.
Yeah.
And usually now, you see, nothing was allowed to interrupt a lesson outside the lesson. Only once do I remember the lesson being stopped for anything besides a purpose for the lesson, and that was when one of the girls had her 18th and 19th birthday, and she stopped the lesson just a little bit early because so we could catch her and give her the bumps before lunch. That was the only time that it was something outside of the lesson that stopped. I mean, we could have a good time and still be working with horses.
Now, all this time, you see Celia. She's out there. You just see her. She's right in your mind, isn't she?
Yeah. Most of the time, anyway.
Well, now, you see, this time she's less on the tape.
Yeah.
Than before. You ought to do something to get it on the tape.
She was ever on her horse was if she'd been working her horse just before the lesson. Otherwise, she sat up and either sat up most of the time she'd sit up in the gallery. And had a speaker system.
Oh, yeah.
And she used it. And she'd sit up in the gallery and smoke and grin down at us occasionally. she would, sometimes, some lessons, especially the ones, the teaching lessons, she never bothered to stay around if we were having a teaching lesson. She'd go wandering up, get up, and stroll across the gallery and stroll out. And we'd be giving somebody Mary Hell down in the school. She'd wander back into the gallery and stand there, listen, grin, and smoke her cigarette, and finally stroll over to the speaker and say, "All right, your time's up. You know, I had 10 or 15 minutes to teach." And then she'd ask for comments from the riders as to how the person had been in strength teaching. And then she'd give her own comments. Usually things like voice. And she'd be very, very matter of fact when she was talking about this. You know, she'd kid around sometimes, but usually she was very matter of fact when she was giving criticism. Your voice is not good, doesn't carry her. We can't understand you. Or with some of them, you're like a mouse in the corner. I can't hear a word you're saying. And then toward exam time, it would be, you'll never pass your exam if you're going to continue to talk like that. You can't expect to pass your exam if the examiners can't hear you. That's all they want to do. They don't care what you say. All they want to do is be able to hear you. And the closer exam time got, the firmer it'd be. And with some. Now, she never jumped Jane. Or not very often. Jane had a very shy, self-conscious manner. But Celia liked Jane. Jane's attitude toward animals appealed to Celia. Celia liked it. And she saw Jane. She saw Jane as being a child, much more than, you know. See, the rest of us were. Jane was the youngest, but even more than that, Jane's whole attitude and everything, and her towards animals and towards fun and everything. See, I think so I saw her mostly, saw her so much as a child, and she would never, very, very rarely jump Jane about anything.
Mm-hmm.
She would come up and say, "Now, Jane, you're going to have to talk louder in the lesson for the exam." And just before the exam, we had a lesson, and Jane gave it, and we had such a good time in that lesson. Jane was cutting up, and we had great fun. And Celia sat in the gallery, and there was somebody else there, but she just sat. They had this kind of chair, these chairs that go, you know, move back and forth and turn around in. And she was leaning back in her chair, just smiling and watching the whole lesson. And she didn't say much, except once when we got terribly loud because Jane gave a demonstration on a little pony, and the pony was bucking, and we decided we'd cheer her on. And things like ride him and sit in and all this sort of thing. Or no, it was one of the other girls was riding, and Jane was giving the instructions, and she got loud in this rough voice that she used, these army commands, you know, mimic. And we decided we'd go along and help her, and and there were visitors in the gallery. So see, you decided you better say something, like, you all don't need to help her, she's the instructor, and so forth. And afterwards, after the lesson, she sort of sat up there, and she laughed, and she said, "Jane, it was such a happy lesson, I can't say anything about it."
Well, Jane's feeling for animals, she had a feeling for animals.
Oh, yes.
And Celia recognized
that? Oh, yes. Well, Celia did, too. Celia was much better than Judy talking about animals. She could catch the character of an animal. And when she would describe one of the... She'd get very strong attachments. For any of the animals. And this sort of look in her eye when she would talk about Amanda, for instance. Now, Amanda was her favorite cow,
mm-hmm.
or Abigail, rather, the one with the big eyes,
mm-hmm.
and the little cow with the big eyes. And her mother decided that they couldn't have Abigail calf again after that last calf that nearly killed her. And when Abigail was sick, see, you wouldn't let any of us near her. She says, "I'll take care of her." And she milked her and did everything for her. And she never milked, never did anything, you know, for the cows, except when Abigail was sick. And she just wouldn't let us near her. She just took care of her, mucked out her the cow stall, did all the work for her. And I don't know whether she had her way or not, but she insisted that they should simply retire Abigail. They should not put her down because she was her cow. And she was never like that about any other animal. Even Rowlety, who was Mr. Tilk's old horse and an old favorite, had been put out to pasture, which was unusual at Tilk's because they didn't have the pasture, and they had to put him out with other people. But they made sure that he stayed out at pasture and was not put down. But if, you know, everybody, see, you would always talk about, you know, the day that Rowlety will have to be put down. And, She was not so sentimental that she could about the animals that she couldn't take that. But she had this tremendous, she could see so much the personalities of them.
Oh, could she?
Yeah, she and her mother. Now, see, Judy was not as good as that. Judy was good on people and talked about people and was fond of them. She couldn't stand the thought of a horse being without water all night. If you wanted to get in trouble with Judy, just leave a horse without water for a night, and she would really jump you. But Celia was the one that could just in a few words catch the entire character of an animal. And, for instance, Blackie was Miss Bryan's horse, and she said they were perfectly fit for each other. That Blackie was a mustached, retired army major.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, he had a mustache. He had the long hairs just above his lips in the winter would grow and come down and curl up in a handlebar mustache. And he had he was black and had a high, proud head carriage and a Roman nose. And really did look like a British Army major, retired.
He was just right for...
And he was just right for Miss Bryan.
Miss Bryan.
He took care of her. He bucked Ann off three times, and the next day took Miss Bryan for a hack, and she complained that he was lazy. And he probably was with her. He took care of her. And Corey, she said she knew Corey was vain. He was just as vain as he could be. He was a playboy. London playboy.
Mm.
And usually she didn't put them into categories like that. That was as a game. They had done it one time, and she'd go through it and point out why they were like this. But now, Tickner, for instance, was this pony that was absolutely gorgeous, little pony. And to see if she was a blonde society girl, she was a Palomino. She was a blonde society girl with long hair, you know, and always fussing with her makeup. I'm trying to think. I can remember at lunch several times when she had gone to a show or something. She would talk about some horse that she had seen, and she would describe it, and it would just come alive. But I can't remember any specific, you know, instance.
Now that's the end of the session this morning on Saturday morning after breakfast, way on up past breakfast on Saturday morning, the 6th of December, 69. This is Channel 2 Over around 205, Channel 2 Over. Channel 2 Over, 205, and the end of the session after breakfast on Saturday morning, the 6th of December, 69.
All right, now, Father, after talking of that sedate atmosphere that you had there.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, there's this theory about horses that applies in racing stables, especially where the horse is supposed to get the best care. Sarah Bowater had just spent her summer or whatever working at a racing stable, and she came and she couldn't get over the tilt, because when we came out on the yard in the morning to muck out, first thing you do before you fed the horses, you'd take your radio and you put it in a nice convenient place in the yard and turn it up full blast so that you could hear it when you went down clear to the other end of the yard to feed. Then you kept the radio stayed on from then till breakfast time. And after breakfast, you'd come back down and start grooming your horse, and you'd take your radio in the stall with you. And I found that I had a special place in every stall, in every box, where I would put my radio out of the horse's reach. And I only had one horse that would really bother.
You did that.
Yes, I bought a radio especially for this. Especially for that. Never had one before, and I don't use it now, but I had one there for that. And in Candy's stall, it was on the ledge of the partition. You know, the partition had a strip along the top of it, And I'd put my radio up there, and Candy was the only one that would ever reach up and pull it down.
Oh.
All the rest of them left alone. Yeah. But he enjoyed it. Oh, they all enjoyed it. They liked it. And Sarah would go along, she'd say, "Now, Mrs., the woman that ran our stable wouldn't let us play a radio on the yard. A radio was not allowed on the yard. And we couldn't even touch the horses as we went by the box because she said it taught them to bite."
Who's that then?
Mrs. Sara. She was the one that had been working at this racing stable. She said we weren't allowed to touch the horses as we went by because she said it would teach them to bite, to reach over the stalls and bite. And, of course, we mucked around with our horses all the time. And Tilk's horses were used to that sort of thing. And we had 2-3 horses come in from outside to stay. And a couple of them had been, one of them was Raja. Raja was a great big, huge 17-2 hand animal hunter. Big bone and sweet eyes. Just a sweet eye. But he was nervous. He'd just cringe. Every time you tried to mount him, he'd jump out from under you when you'd mount him. And in the box, he was nervous. And he stayed with us for about, at the end of about a month, one of the little girls was climbing all over that horse, and he never even flicked an ear. He just had gotten used to it. And he was the sweetest old horse. Just as willing. He wasn't really all that old. He was only 5 or 6. He looked old because there was something about his face that always, even when he was a 2-year-old, he must have looked like he was, about 18. An old horse. And very willing on his jumps and everything. Even though he'd never seen a jump before, he'd jump it. And then he was very clumsy. And sometimes he'd hit him badly, but he'd try. He was quite willing to try. And when he first came, he was nervous about everything. And we'd get while we were waiting for a lesson, we'd just, like I do with these horses here, just fool around with him at the end of having him follow you without holding onto the reins or something like that, just as a lark. And the exercises we did in the lessons, of course, got him used to people moving around on his back. But it was the things on the yard that helped him more than anything. And letting Nikki Denara even get on that horse. And she crawled all over him, and he just stood there and never flinched.
Who got her clawing all over him?
Nikki Denara. She was one of the little girls, the 10 or 11-year-olds that had a pony out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'd go screeching down the yard, running as fast as we could go and yelling at somebody. I mean, that was enough to get us fired at some of these fancy racehorse stables. And the horses, she hated to put a horse in the cage boxes because nothing ever happened in the cage boxes. And she thought they ought to be in a stall where they can see what's happening,
mm-hmm.
in a box where they can see out onto the yard. And the horses loved it. They just come to look over the gate and watch what was going on. And we'd fool around. Sometimes we'd have 10 or 15 minutes. 10 or 15 minutes with nothing to do. And we'd go out and see all the yard was paved. All of it. This is
paved?
Paved. The stalls all had concrete floors. And the whole area was paved because it would have been a mud house. Nothing but mud if it hadn't been. And on warm days, come spring, we'd all get out. We have a few minutes in between the lessons, or towards summer when we began turning horses out, all of a sudden the work slackened up. And it was leisure, and it was great. And we'd get out there we'd finish what we had to do by about 10:30 and didn't ride till 11:30. And we'd come out and we'd get the kitten out in that square concrete, warm concrete, and just lie in the middle of the yard and stare at the horses, looking over the door and talk to them, play with the kitten, and occasionally we'd get roughhousy and run around or something. And I've got some marvelous pictures of the whole group of us. We'd gotten this, it was in the late fall, and there was this cart horse mare that was being offered for sale, and Elaine had spent the whole morning on her, getting her tail washed and oiling her hooves. This great big, her hair was 6 inches long, and fuzzy all over, teddy bear, and she was huge and just built like a cart horse and had a sweet face. And she was sweet. She'd do anything you wanted. Anything. But she was just, and she was cuddly, just as cuddly as she could be. And Elaine had spent the whole morning getting this cart horse to look spiffy, with oil on her feet and the tail, with tail bandage on, and all this. And Celia had washed Corey that morning as well, because it was a mild morning, and we didn't have too many of them. Whenever we had one, well, we'd take advantage of it to wash the horses or do whatever had to be done. And Celia had washed Corey, and Judy was, in some rare moment, good humor, good mood, was walking Corey for Celia. And first of all, we ran around taking pictures of Lucy. And we all got on Lucy, and I've got a picture of all of us, about three or four people on Lucy. And Canadian Anne just skylarking around her head, and I was sitting underneath her. And Elaine, I think, took the picture. And
I saw that.
Yeah, I guess you did. Yeah. And I was fooling around, and Judy had Corey and was just wandering around with him, sort of on the end of this rope, more or less on the end of the rope, depending. And Anne had been grooming Beaky, who was her horse to groom. And she was swinging on Beaky's door. Beaky was in his stall all the time. She was swinging on his stall door. And Judy was standing around with this horse, sort of more or less held by her, wandering around her, just seeing whatever he wanted to do. And all of us seemed to have a spare moment at that time. And we were standing around chatting, and Anne swinging on that door, and Silver with my horse with his head over his door. He was great big gray, well, white. He was old enough to be white. Was very much a gentleman, very, very, very much a gentleman, very proper. Very proper. But he was looking over his door. Now, he was one who always had to see what was going on. And he was watching this. And Judy walked up to him to talk to Anne. And now most people, when they lead a horse, if you were going to be in a racing stable, you would lead one valuable horse up and put it right next to another horse where they could bite each other. Judy walks up with just the end of the rope in her hands to talk to Anne. And Silver and Corey began to talk. And they just, snorting at each other. And then Silver reached over and grabbed Corey's halter. And Corey would open his mouth and go, rawr, back at Silver. And Silver would grab his halter and they'd shake their heads up and down. And nobody paid any attention. Nobody said, all right, Corey, quit it. Or, look, Silver, stop it. Somebody pointed out, look at him, and then everybody laughed. Nobody moved Corey at all. And they weren't screaming at each other or anything. They were just talking. But now, see, that sort of thing can get you fired just so easily at one of these fancy racing stables. Sorrow never ceased to be amazed at it. I don't think she ever quite got used to it.
Well, is that what these horses are doing? Stand up here just watching everything goes on?
Sure, horses are curious. They love to watch what goes on. There are not many horses that are happy where they can't see what's going on. They like to be able to stick their head over a door and watch. And some of them are more curious than others. Now, some of them will just stand in the back of the stall. But now, the little Arabian I worked with used to just stand poised right at the edge of her door, watching everything. Ears pricked, eyes bright, just watch everything. She'd, and and it didn't upset her if something exciting was happening on the yard, but she'd watch, you know? And every horse that was led up and down, she'd watch to see where they went. You could lead her out and handle her, and she wouldn't jump or anything. She wasn't nervous, but she just loved it, just had to know what's going on. And Elaine was the only one who would do this. Some of the horses would eat straw over the doors, and the straw would get on the yards, and those yards had to be swept. Great big push brooms. And sweep the yard 2 or 3 times a day. Those yards were huge. And so Elaine, to avoid work, would close the doors on the horses that ate straw over the door. And she closed the door on that little Arabian, and that little horse nearly threw a fit. Oh, she ran around her stall a bit and kicked the walls and gently complained.
Oh, really?
I came along and opened the door. I used to follow Elaine around opening doors. I really did. I couldn't stand it. She'd go along and shut the door on one of my horses, and I'd be there in a second to open it again and tell her to leave my horses alone. Even if it was her yard.
But those damn radios. You mean they can stand those? They want to hear those radios?
Why, yeah.
And you got that. There's nothing on them but all that awful music.
Well, that's what everybody knew and everybody talked about. And besides, it's not all that awful. It's good music to work to. A lot of it is.
Well, I just put you in the institution.
Well, that's a minor point.
Did you do that before you went over there?
What? Lit radio?
Yeah.
No, it was records before I went over there.
Well, that's the same thing.
Same thing, yeah.
You had the same thing on the records?
No, it was slightly different. Slightly different.
Just slightly.
Well, no, you got to understand, there's a big difference.
I wouldn't be able to detect it.
No, maybe not, but there is a difference. What I listened to before was stuff like, a lot of Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was it. I mean, you know, Bob Dylan and this little girl named she started as a folk singer,
yeah.
And now she sings a lot of protest songs.
Yeah.
Well,
now, just what was it? What had you written to Bob Dylan
for? Well, you see, it was like this, guy. I moved into my room my freshman year at the center, and I discovered that one of the things they supply you with is a roommate.
Yeah.
Now, my roommate was pretty sweet,
yeah.
And she had a record player. Or no, she didn't have a record player. She had records, but no record player. And the girl next door was from Knoxville. Her dad's in law and teaches at the university. And she had gone through Beatlemania. And so had Ellen. They were both crazy about the Beatles. So she had a record player. And the girl that she was rooming with couldn't stand a sound while she was studying. Not the pin to drop. Anything.
Yeah.
Just the slightest little sound and
yeah.
Broke her concentration.
Well, I like her.
I didn't. None of us did. It's terrible to have somebody like that next to you.
Yeah.
So she moved her record player into our room. And I got introduced to the Beatles. And I found out, for one thing, the Beatles were not what I thought they were. They made pretty good music. I didn't care much for the lyrics, but they made pretty good music. And the next thing they went on to was Dylan. Now, Dylan's lyrics were pretty good, but I couldn't stand the music until I got used to it. They played Dylan. They started with Dylan, and they played Dylan 24 hours a day. if they could have, they would have. Unfortunately, thank heavens for quiet, things like quiet hours when they weren't allowed to have the record player on. But whenever they could, it was Dylan. I lived it. I had lived with Dylan. I mean, there wasn't anything else. I did my papers to Dylan. I did everything to Dylan. And pretty soon I decided that he wasn't what I thought he was after all.
Yeah.
And then they went into moved from Dylan. They moved in two directions. They went into a lot of the psychedelic music. Things like this is something completely different from Dylan. This is stuff like the Stones, and that's not a very good example. They're a lot better groups. The Cream, best group, and they are good. Cream. They've broken up now, but they were good. They were from the three, the best guitarist, the best drummer, and the best, bass guitar in the country. Decided they'd get together and form a group, and they called it the Cream, and it was top. I mean, there wasn't anything like the Cream. And their records are good. For what, in the style of music they play, they are good. But
you all went in for that.
And that was the Cream and Mothers of Invention, that sort of records. And they got further and further out on those. And some of them I really didn't like. Some of them were pretty good. And the other was they went in the opposite direction, backtracking on Dylan to singers like, let me see if I remember the boy's name. He's a, hold on a second, name of the album that I know. And he's folk, and he's gone back, this is back to folk, not even folk rock.
Mm-hmm.
Just, and it's not. There was Tom somebody or other was one. His songs were really, they sounded like something out of the 30s. So they were all composed, or most of them were composed. He did one thing that's I really liked. I didn't like the rest of the album, and a lot of it was sort of crude. But there was one thing he did is the song's about a woman who's leaving her man, and he takes her down to the train station, and she keeps asking him what the various trains are that goes by, and he says the refrain of the song is well, that's such and such train, the one you want sounds like this, and he does it on the guitar, and it's fantastic, really. The beat of the song is just plain hard-hitting blues. Blues is what it is. And that guitar is just out of this world. Then the other guy does blues. He's a bit more up-to-date. Not country blues. And he's got one song, the last song on the album, called Yesterday and Today, in which he does counterpoint. He uses double records his voice and does counterpoint. It's just fabulous. But I would have bought those records. I would have just skipped over them in a record catalog. And I never bought a record that I didn't hear in there from them first. I'd hear it over and over and over again, and then when I'd live with it for a while, I'd decide whether I wanted it or not. I never liked a record the first time I heard it. Or occasionally I would, and if I liked it the first time I heard it, I knew there probably wasn't much in it. And it's usually right. It's usually a bit too commercial, too smooth.
Now that was Center.
That was at Center,
that
yeah.
That contribution was Center.
Yeah. Now in England, it was all commercial.
On the BBC.
On the BBC. It was all stuff like the Stones and wasn't any of these little groups that you never hear about,
mm-hmm.
that you can get on the record. And it wasn't any blues. It was all the commercial singers. And
you could just take that, turn on your radio out in the yard.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't need records.
Oh, we had them. We had a record player. and we played records. Certain records, you see, there was one girl who could always spot what record was going to be number one in the charts. And she'd spot it when it first came out, and then you'd hear it over and over and over again till you got sick of it. And then she'd buy the record. And so there are certain records that just will always... Now, this is true of Center. There's certain records that I can remember from Center that always just bring up a scene, just like that. And there's certain records that I can hear that'll bring up scenes at Windmill Hill, just the same way. It's not that I like the records. Some of them I detested. It's what goes with them. Since I've been over here. A couple. That's why I'm completely out of it over here. I don't know what's number one over here. I can tell you what was number one in England.
Actually is now.
I know there's been a couple of rock festivals someplace and the people on the news commentary are completely anti. But that's about all I can tell. It's been anti.
It thrives on the anti season.
I don't know.
When did you get to read over there?
Whenever I decided I was going to.
Out there in the yard, the tea room?
I would just retire to my room. Could never read much in the club room, it was too crowded.
How many in your room?
Me. One.
And you could retire to your room?
Yes. And did. Especially around exam time. There were about 3 or 4 exams while I was there, including my own. I think there were 4, including my own.
Mm-hmm.
And it would begin to get a little tight on around the yard. I couldn't stand being around nervous people, and everybody would get nervous toward exam time. So I would retreat to my room for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and avoid all that nervousness.
Avoid it, yeah.
Well, you never mentioned going to your room.
Well... When I first went, I figured I'd just light out and go on walks. Then I discovered one of the great sad facts of working outside like that is that by the time you're through working, you're too tired to take off on a walk. And I'd do it occasionally when the weather was good. I did it in the spring.
So, when you got through work, you...
Well, if it depends. You see, the great thing about it was that when we were on... early shift, because then I could go on to my room from 3:30 until 4:35, have that time completely to myself, nobody bothering me at all, and then go in and be sociable in the evening.
Oh.
But when we stopped shift work, I just had to decide I was just not going into the club room. Sometimes it'd be a week and I wouldn't go into the club room.
You mean really?
Yeah, I'm serious. I'd go in there for supper, for tea, and then after that I'd leave. And Trudy or Jane would fill me in on the news when I was mucking out the stalls the next morning. We mucked out in a group together. And we'd chat and fill each other in on news and stuff like that.
Local news,
yeah. And,
So you didn't have to be in the club room all the time?
No, I didn't have to take part in it.
But generally, it was pretty well attended?
Generally, most of us were in there. Generally. Not always.
Well, while you were working, you didn't get to talk very much, did you?
Not for very long at a time.
So after supper would be the tea time.
Around tea time, we used to try to take a break around 10:30, 11, for about half an hour.
And then tea time.
And then at tea time, and you had all evening then. But the best talking time was when you could eliminate about 6 of the people, and we just have 2 or 3 of you.
In the club room.
In the club room, and that couldn't usually be managed till about 10:30, 11.
But that's when you liked it.
Yeah. But couldn't always be like that. Now some evenings, the whole, see, when Trudy, Trudy started going out, she and Judy would be out, and Celia would be with Mike, and got so quite frequently there was just Jane and me. And sometimes neither one of us would go to the club room. We were both had a tendency to just retire to our rooms occasionally. We wouldn't see anybody.
Had you had the impression that they ever had a room?
Yeah, I knew they had a room by themselves.
Hey, no. They loved it.
Judy and Judy.
Mm-hmm. Used to always be confused. Because Trudy spelled her name with a Y. And Judy spelled hers with an I.
Oh.
And she would insist on spelling Trudy with an I. Because she liked her name spelled with an I. And everybody else would make the mistake and spell Judy with a Y. There was always great confusion about that.
The village now, Barbara, you couldn't get into the village.
No, I couldn't. I couldn't even tell you what sort of people made up the village. In Jane's village, there was the vicar and the woman who kept the shop, the village store, and a few people who had farms just right around the village. They were farmers. But her village was very small, and Snitterfield and Hampton Lucy, where I was, both big, very large for villages. And I don't know even who, you know, what sort of people lived in Snitterfield.
Now, the Historical Society, at the time you went, were they villagers?
Yes, they were villagers.
And interested in history.
Yeah. Yeah. And fed a good membership. 50, 60 people out of that little village. They did what, I mean, you know, they were certainly the interesting. But I didn't talk with them. I mean, you know, I didn't circulate among the people very well. I listened a lot, but you don't necessarily pick up anything unless you're in a conversation.
But they're pretty. Picturesque.
What, the villages? Snitterfield wasn't particularly picturesque. It was too big. But Hampton Lucy was nice. I liked Hampton Lucy. Hampton Lucy had Hampton Lucy pub, where we always went for our drinks. And Hampton Lucy pub was a local pub, but it wasn't exclusively local that we felt we couldn't go in and just be really relaxed and have a half pint of cider. And the cider was rough cider, only 9 pence a glass. It was good cider too. And we used to ride around Hampton Lucy. That was one of the hacks of the hack to Hampton Lucy. And it had, it was the only village in the area that had some cottages with thatch roofs. You see a lot of them down south, but not many that far north.
Yeah.
With the thatch roofs and the window boxes with flowers. But even Hampton Lucy, they had the church too. The church was a miniature copy of, let me get it straight. Lord of the Manor had this copy built because he wanted it. And it was a beautiful church from the outside. I was never inside. I was told that it was just as lovely inside as it was outside. I never went inside. But it was gorgeous, and especially right in the afternoon sun.
And that was a village church?
That was a village church, yeah. Now, most of them, the village church in Jane's village was a little stone Norman, early Norman church.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to be quite well known, one of the churches that tourists came to visit quite frequently. And it was rougher. It was a good deal rougher than Snitterfield Church. Snitterfield Church was also Norman. And a very pretty church inside. But church in Jane's Village was much, much rougher. I lived in hill country.
Now, does that sort of life you led there at the Tilks, does that have anything in common with Ishmael on the Pequot?
It's people, the same people. Pretty much all the time. And it's not even like living in a village. There aren't that many people. We didn't feel isolated. After all, we could go to town, or we could go to Stratford, or we could go to Birmingham, or we could go whatever. And there was nothing to keep us from going out with boys from Warwick or whatever. Didn't. Most of us didn't. Much work to do and too much to keep us occupied. So it was pretty much a sort of little closed community.
Like the Pequot.
Yeah, like the Pequot. I'm gonna take a look at people. If you wanted to. Not so much time to take a look at them. It's time to just share so many experiences with them that certain things about them just became those people. So if you try and look at a person, you see too many things.
Mm.
You don't see what makes them individual. Whereas if you live in with those people for that long, just certain things stand out about them.
Well, that's the way Odysseus came into life. He's not a study. And in that German book, that's the way Abraham and Isaac, all those people came to life. Tribal, communal, you know, within the group. So it's not mental or intellectual.
But getting to know. If you try to be mental about it, you see too much.
Mm.
You got to be able to be blind.
Well, now, you did that with Judy. All those, I think you brought out more about her as you talked to her and talked about her than you knew about her. And then what you brought out was counter to your judgment of her.
Well, what I brought out was, I don't know, it's just hard to report on the worst of people. It doesn't come out. Now, when I'm talking about Elaine, the same thing would happen. But it was Judy was that I could never I could be objective about it and see the lift she's got, but I still can't ever forgive her for that comment she made me out one day. I never will. I too much.
But still, you lived above it. Every time you saw Jane work with her, you didn't think about that.
Sometimes I didn't. When you didn't, it was miserable. That was the trouble with Elaine. I'd have to get really mad at Elaine and cuss her out once so that I could just forget her for a while.
All right.
And then it would build up again and I'd be miserable for weeks.
Well,
until I could cuss her out again for something, and then I'd
forget her again.
Do you suppose Ishmael was miserable for weeks? I don't say I'd avoid it.
I think he was. He probably was. I don't think it'd be easy for somebody to be teaching school and go avoid a whaler. Doesn't sound like the most pleasant captain in the world. The Ahab wasn't the one that...
Or you might say reporting, you rise above the... The spirit in which you observe it. That wouldn't be right. It's not the manor house, then, it's just the Pequod. You don't have that at all, that spirit of my own hour, and that spirit of liberality that she speaks of, you know, in the school.
It wasn't a tilt. I had time to myself. It was practically, it wasn't stolen time, but it was fought for. And it was intended to be more like moments like milking the cow, which would be about like being on the masthead. When you're really supposed to be looking out for something else. And time is my...
Well, now, the manor house is in the screw, but it's not in the Moby Dick. So your experience is close to Moby Dick and not the screw in that respect. You just communicate with people on the move, by and large.
Oh, no.
Well, that's nice, isn't it? What's wrong with that?
That's the end of this little session on Saturday night after supper. It's 9 o'clock, about time for Billy Graham. And the end of this is 8:50, Channel 2 over. 8:50, Channel 2 over. Saturday night, 6th of December, 69. I thought I'd been in bed way before this. Channel 2 over, and Bertie called tonight. Channel 2 over, 8:50, Saturday night, 6th of December, 69.
Did you have a radio at Tilks, Barbara?